Come on up, you guys. Yeah, we can, we've got a few, we have, and always can add another chair or two to the table. I think we can manage to get our task force members up to the table here.
I'm leaving.
Nolan, why don't you grab a seat?
Then that doesn't mean you have to stay the whole time. It just means that you get to come up to the table to start the conversation.
Okay, we're good to go then.
Where's the works? I had it this morning.
Okay, well, I'll get this started and appreciate the chance to get into a little depth and a little conversation about this early draft of PDC's 5-year strategic plan. We have with us a number of members of our task force who are fresh, if I can use that word, from a meeting that started at 7:30 this morning that where they were reviewing this draft. We got Sam Rodriguez, Sari Iannarone, Diane Freeman, Nolan Leinhart, and Mr. Courtwright, who is here as a resource and been a great one. And then I think do we have any other task force members in the room? Maybe not. We may have a couple more stragglers coming in. Joe has been doing some work beyond this work for the city that is pretty impressive, and some of it's in front of us here. So Patrick's going to walk us through where we are in this process. Again, we wanted to try to keep this pretty informal this morning, give you a chance to hear individually from some of these task force members, and also to push back on what's still an early draft, but that draft has tried to incorporate some of the comments that the team heard from council at the presentation and has heard from the task force over the last couple of meetings. So with that, let me turn it over to Patrick, and I think we'll call on some of our task force members as we go.
Thank you, Mayor Hales. Good morning, commissioners. So we do want to keep this informal, but we are going to walk through a presentation. It's probably longer than it should be, but I'll try and walk through it quickly. But please do feel free to interrupt and ask questions as we go along. The presentation, we'll just get start with the agenda so you can see where we're heading here. Sorry about that. There we go. So what we want to do is we want to walk through the current draft strategic plan, and before we actually get into the substance of the plan, I'll talk about the process that we're going through. We've reported to you a few times on the process, and we'll remind you again where we're at and fill in some things around next steps like outreach. And then we'll walk through the plan, and the plan does have some context setting before we get into the actual actions. And then we've also begun to kind of throw out some outcomes on this. But the main point today is obviously the discussion piece, and you can see some of the questions that these are the questions we've been posing to our committee, but other folks around this plan. So we would like to get your reaction to these questions, but also whatever other feedback you have. So just to start with what is the PDC strategic plan? What does it do? We operate under a 5-year strategic plan, and so it serves a particular role for us. It also provides more of a strategic context for our work and the city's objectives around economic development and redevelopment. But it really, for us, it's really here's what we're trying to accomplish over the next 5-year period: goals, objectives, outcomes. You can see that, and then we use that on an annual basis to establish our own work plan and our budget. So, for example, on Thursday, the PDC board meets for its annual retreat, and what we do is we show them a draft work plan for the coming fiscal year. They give us feedback on that work plan so that we can then prepare a draft budget for them to see in January, and then we go through the budget process. That entire structure is based on our strategic plan. The document that you have in front of you that we're going to walk through is a straw proposal. It's a 20% draft. It is not in any way meant to say here's our strategic plan. It's here's the the collection of ideas and thoughts that we've pulled together and have reviewed with our steering committee, and we want your reaction on it so that we can refine it before we go forward. You've seen this slide a few times. The process, we've updated you on where we're at. You can see, you know, we're in the middle of this fairly intense period of feedback from our steering committee, from city council, as well as our board. How we got here was we convened a steering committee, and I'll show you in a second who's on the steering committee, but we convened a steering committee, began our conversations, but then we hired a firm, Market Street Services, to do an assessment. They came back with that assessment. They presented to council last week, so you've seen that assessment. I think if you don't have a copy of it with you, we have extra copies. But so we had that conversation with council, but we used that assessment and the recommendations from that assessment to prepare the first draft framework. The committee had a chance to look at the draft framework a couple times now, and so the document you have is a result of that feedback. Once we have these conversations, this week we'll begin work on an updated draft document, and I'll show you in a second how we're going to begin to incorporate more input into that. But what's next really is, after we have an updated document, we will go out to the public fairly broadly, take feedback from the public for roughly two months, and then at the end of that period we'll come back with a final draft for final review by the PDC board and city council. Our hope is to have a document in place so that when we finish the budget process for the 15-16, we'll actually have this framework to use. Here is who's on the steering committee. We've presented this list to you in the past. We have representatives here from the steering committee who will participate in the conversation, share some of their thoughts on how it's going. But the goal here was to invite a group that was representative of both the work that we do, but also some of the aspirations going forward, particularly around thinking about how we make more of an emphasis on East Portland neighborhoods where that have been historically disinvested, and also thinking about how we make greater connections with the local workforce.
And I might just add that not only have we been getting great participation at the regular meetings, but that there have been subgroups of this committee that have been meeting and trying to flesh out particular issues, like what does our livable neighborhoods agenda really look like? What do we mean by a quality job? So those kinds of caucus efforts have been breaking out among this committee, as well as they're showing up, reliably to dialogue with us, monthly. But it just shows how energized I think this process is with their help.
Yeah, needless to say, they've been giving us significant amounts of their time. Very, very much appreciate it. So the next slide you'll see is a summary of both the outreach and input that we've received to date, where we've received it, and what our plans are going forward. To date, you can see the steering committee has been the main body that's been providing feedback. These rump groups that you see below are the groups that the mayor referenced. These are subgroups of the committee that have gotten together to discuss a number of different topics. We've also shared this with our Neighborhood Economic Development Leadership Group. That's about a 30-person group that's been operational for about 3 years now that really guides much of our community economic development work. We're sharing it now with you, and PDC staff has had a chance to weigh in on it. As we go from here, and the PDC board will weigh in on it obviously this week, from here we have another set of informal conversations that we're going to have over the next month to help us get to the 50% draft. So before we go formally out for public outreach, we do want to check in with the groups you see here in kind of this fashion, sit down and walk through the document and get their feedback. A lot of it is around the likely partners, both city partners and other partners in our work. Some of it's around kind of key stakeholders for the plan. But things like, you know, the higher education representatives, PSU, OHSU, the community colleges, that you'll see in the plan that there's a significant aspiration to begin to make stronger connections between the job growth, economic development, and redevelopment activities that we engage in and local workforce. And so I think that this is going to require a much broader conversation than just what PDC can do. And we want to obviously get those, have those conversations happen early. And then you know that we've been in a longstanding relationship with the Brookings Institution. They've been great partners for us on a number of different areas of our work. We've actually are sharing the drafts of this with them and getting their feedback. They're trying to tackle this, the set of issues that we identify here nationally, and they want to see that cities like Portland are on the ground trying to figure this stuff out. Really, this issue, these issues around inequality and around access to quality jobs, and so they've been helpful for us in thinking through the document. Once we get the 50% draft, then we do the more formal public outreach, and you can see what we have here. We would love any feedback on this, both in terms of the form in which we go see public feedback, but also any groups that we've missed here. We do plan open houses. We'd like to make use of some of the online tools that now exist to get feedback. We use a tool called Peak Democracy for some of our stuff. You see, for like Lentz, we'll ask people to go online and tell us what they want to see with particular properties, so we can make use of those kind of online tools. But we will actively reach out to all the groups that you see here and any others that you'd like us to talk to, and we are open to invitations as well, you know, to appear and share the plan. It's something we look forward to. I think it's going to be a fun conversation when we have a more complete draft. So now into the kind of the meat of the plan, and let me just start by the next slide. This current strategic plan framework is our current strategic plan. So it just helps kind of ground you in how we've think about our strategic plan. It's the one we're operating under has five objectives or outcomes. The three, if you look at the diagram here with the circles, the three internal ones are the kind of major bodies of our work. So the strong economic growth was the traded sector piece of our work. The vibrant central city was the redevelopment work that we do in the central city. And healthy neighborhoods was a combination of the redevelopment work that we do in our neighborhoods as well as our community economic development work. And then overlaying that was an emphasis on social equity. And then effective stewardship is the way that we think about how we manage the agency in a responsible way. So this is the structure that we've been operating under for the past 5 years, and it actually is reflected in how we're structured as an entity, as an agency. So what you'll see when we go into the new structure, we actually are thinking about a new way of looking at this that will change the way that we actually operate, but it'll also change the way I think people who interact with us, who work with us, think about our work. It's, you know, so
are you proposing to change this framework?
Well, we'll show you in a second. Yeah, the framework is different. I mean, so there's things that we think are unnecessarily siloed because of the way this framework exists. But so one example of kind of how we make use of the strategic plan is our budget. So you can see is this our current year? This is the 14-15 budget. So this is a 14-15 budget. So this is an annual, just a one-year snapshot of our budget, and you can see how it breaks down by these. It's not really the five areas. You see the three areas, and then the last slice there, the real estate FBO administration, is the stewardship goal. The social equity goal is embedded in all the work we do. But you can see how, okay, so this is how we budget. We and where our money goes, and then what we've shown you here as well is how the distribution of TIF versus non-TIF. So the little pie chart in each of these areas is the gray is TIF and the black is non-TIF. So our redevelopment work obviously is 100% funded by TIF, but when you talk about the two other strategic priorities, healthy neighborhoods and traded sector work, a lot of that is general fund supported. So this strategic plan has impact in how we think about our general fund ask.
Commissioner. Patrick, I don't really know what this means. I don't know what spending $86 billion on a vibrant central city means. I mean, I know that we spend 30% of our TIF money on housing. And you told me recently, and I appreciate you got back to me so fast, that over the past 10 years, I think it was, we spent 15% of TIF money on transportation, although that's gone down a bit in the last few years. And those are categories I can sink my teeth into. But vibrant central city and even healthy neighborhoods seem kind of opaque. Is it possible to break down our spending into categories that are sort of more relatable, like housing, transportation, et cetera?
Yeah, so we do two slices of our budget. So we do the slice this way, strategic priority, which does mix the TIF and non-TIF, because we do have an integrated kind of way of doing our work, but we also have what we call business line budget categories, and we present those as well. So our business line, the way that we track it, is business development, which is kind of the economic development side of things, but includes loans and TIF-funded loans. But housing, infrastructure for our purposes, we include both transportation and parks and open spaces. Property redevelopment is the biggest category, and that can be both neighborhood and central city redevelopment work, and then administration, which is the, once again, it's not just the operations of the agency, but also things like property management. So we manage our real estate portfolio through that, and our loan portfolio.
So when you say it's the biggest, I mean, how much of each of these categories do you think would fall into property redevelopment, vibrant central city and healthy neighborhoods, for example?
So so for 14-15, the current distribution is that 59% of our expenditures are in property redevelopment across all of our urban renewal areas.
Why isn't there a little pie chart for the real estate section?
This is basically all overhead.
This is all TIF. Oh, well, it's not all TIF. It's all overhead, and there is an allocation between TIF and general fund, but it's mostly TIF funded.
So it's 100% TIF?
It's not 100% TIF. There's some overhead that's allocated to the general fund dollars that we get, and some overhead attached to other funding sources. So we can get you a number.
Yeah.
We can get you a number. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask a related question?
Yeah.
Because this says budget allocation by strategic priority, but actually housing is not your strategic priority. You're a pass-through to the Housing Bureau. So did you pull out the 30%? Is this the
70%? Yes.
Yes.
This is net.
Yeah. So this is the pie chart.
This is
for the
PDC, 70%. Yeah. Just the PDC part. Does that help? Are we, So the moving into the new strategic plan, as we mentioned, the first thing we did was we hired Market Street, and they came and reported last week to council their assessment of our work and recommendations. And so we've summarized it here. You heard a much more detailed presentation than this one slide here. But just to recap, I think their findings affirmed the PDC role in the various parts of our work, and it established, the accomplishments to date around things like exports and entrepreneurship, things around traded sector job growth, but it also, it also highlighted some areas for us to work on, which, in our neighborhood work, we're in 2011, we embarked on a new approach to neighborhood economic development. It required a culture shift for us, and so a lot of the interviews that Market Street did with our stakeholders were, this is a great approach. We agree with this approach, but PDC's learning, just like we are, so it's relatively new for everybody, and that's kind of a new role for us to be in that learning model. The neighborhood work is also complex. The interviews recognize that, and so there's a sense that we're you know, we and our partners are still trying to figure out how the neighborhood economic development strategy can truly be effective. On the trade sector side, I think they, like a lot of people, they've suggested that we update our cluster portfolio, and so you'll see that in our draft strategic plan. And then, you know, I think the last thing is they're asking us to look for opportunities to leverage more players. They see us in a variety of roles, some of which fit our unique role, as it says at the top, but some of them which, in their mind, call out for other organizations to play a role. And so the draft plan is beginning to explore that topic as well.
What's the dollar amount and the percentage of your budget that currently goes for neighborhood economic development?
It would be, we can get you the exact figure, but I think we're at this 17% number within this pie. So it's, you know, it's 17% of $33 million. Probably, I don't know, what is that, $5-6 million. And that's a combination of, yeah. So that's general fund. There's some TIF that would go into it, but it's really general fund funded or non-TIF funded. We'll verify that. We can pull that out. So the Market Street presentation last week, I think, was also interesting from a data perspective, and they shared with you the data, the work that they've done looking regionally at Portland across a number of different variables, innovation, employment, talent, quality of life. What we've shared with you here actually is a follow-up to that conversation. You had asked about Portland-specific data as opposed to regional data. And so this is the data that is available out of that, the larger data set they shared with you. This is the data that is available both for Portland, but also the peer cities at a similar scale. Now, we just finished a steering committee meeting in which we had a fairly robust conversation about this. From the Portland data, for example, is Multnomah County. So in some respects, we're limited in how much of a Portland-only look we can do with data based on how it's collected, and a lot of the data is Multnomah County data versus City of Portland data. It was actually true of the previous economic development strategy. But the same thing is true across the board. What's the definition of Austin, Denver, Minneapolis? And so in some respects, you have cities, some respects you have cities and suburbs combined. It's a different definition, so it's not necessarily apples to apples. The regional look is actually, I think, a more statistically valid in that respect, but we were asked to take a look at this. So what you see here is this comparison, and we can certainly get into this maybe during the discussion, because we want to dig into the meat of the strategic plan. But you can see where we rank, and it's not a pretty picture when you look at the city level data relative to the peer cities. I think there's some questions that have been raised. Joe's on our steering committee, as well as John Taponia, and they've raised some questions about how the validity of this data, if you really aren't comparing similar geographies. Multnomah County versus King County is a very kind of different comparison.
Well, you thought, Joe, too, that first one, that the one-year number, that there's probably a data problem there, right?
It's not consistent with other data that I've looked at, but I'd want to see where they got that number from, yeah.
So we're going to get, in a second, we're going to walk through the beginning, a part of the plan, which is kind of opportunities, but also challenges. And the data is that we have, this and other data, is really kind of feeds into that. I don't think that some of the issues we have with the data really impact the assumptions we're making, but that's where I think we should think about this, is because while we probably are seeing higher job growth than what you're seeing here, you know, we're beginning to talk about where is the job growth occurring and what occupations, who's filling those jobs, you know, so it gets into kind of the next level down. But I think that's where the data matters, is when we begin to talk about the context for the plan, and do we all agree with these assumptions, and so that's how I would ask that we think about this data.
Could we take a minute to look at these other cities and see if you can give us sort of a summary of what the economies of those cities is like? Because, I mean, for some of these places, I think I have some idea of what their economies consist of. Like Seattle, a huge chunk of their economy, I think, is Microsoft, and another huge chunk is Boeing. And we can't, through our little economic development strategies, create Microsoft or Boeing. And I kind of wonder whether it was any economic development strategy of Seattle that led to the existence of Microsoft or Boeing or Amazon. But, I mean, and for Minneapolis, I think they've got, like, you know, 15 Fortune 500 companies there. And that probably helps. And San Jose, obviously, they have a very hot economy as a result of decades, largely, of federal investment in research. And I mean, can speculate about a couple of others, but I'd be interested to know if there's any of the cities that are doing better than us where they don't happen to have huge companies that are their economic bulwarks, but they were able, through a few million a year in economic development investment, build themselves into a powerhouse, to express it in sort of ridiculous terms.
Don't want to put Joe on the spot, but this is why we have Joe Courtwright on our committee. So.
Well, I'll try to give you the short answer. I think you're correct in saying they all have their different industry specializations, and Seattle's, you thumbnailed correctly. From my standpoint, the single biggest factor explaining the differences in economic performance between these metropolitan areas is the educational attainment of the population. Statistically, we can explain 60% of the variation in per capita income among metropolitan areas by knowing one thing: what fraction of the adult population has a four-year degree. And the reason why Seattle, Minneapolis, Denver do better on that per capita indicator than we do is because they all have noticeably higher levels of educational attainment.
But why is that? I mean, they didn't just decide that everybody's going to graduate from college.
Well, it's a and fairly put, Commissioner Novick. It's a combination of things. I'd say two things. One, these are places that over time have had more robust investments in education, K-12 and higher education. And then it's attracting talented people, too. And that's something that we've made a lot of progress on in the last couple of decades here, but are still lagging behind those other cities.
Can I ask you just a favor? So on this question, I was also going to call on Diane Frame, and she has to leave in like 5 minutes. So if I can ask that Diane weighs in, because Diane operates, she's based in Portland, but she's seeing what's going on in some of these other markets, particularly around software technology firms. So maybe you want to weigh in on kind of how you see the Portland economy relative to some of these other economies.
Yeah, I mean, so as these folks know, the education issue is the hot button that I've got on this as well. And actually, I'd point to K-12, to be honest with you, because if you look at the technology sector, we've done an unbelievable job here at being able to attract money as well as companies to move here. These are all young people, though, with young families, and they're sitting here comparing ourselves to Austin and to Seattle and to Minneapolis, and they're actually looking at the K-12. We're getting kids who are highly educated from the best institutions in the country moving here, and they're moving here for jobs sometimes, and in some cases they're moving here because they think they can find jobs, and I speak specifically to the tech sector. Where we're losing is when we're evaluated against these other cities with young families saying, what is the school situation for raising my family? They haven't made any money yet. They have hopes of making a whole lot of money. And there's been a lot of investment, upwards of $1 billion, that have been put into this city in venture capital and other private equity funds that are growing these companies in a way that we're going to have outcomes that are going to generate more wealth. But the educational question is absolutely, I would put at the very top of it. The second piece, just since I am going to leave, and I think really to where Sarah's been poking at as well, which I agree to completely, and that is not just around the neighborhoods, but the way that we connect to those neighborhoods, both in terms of real, what she would call hard, and I'm going to let you go into it further, but hard, whether that's our transportation systems, our broadband, et cetera. But the other thing that is valued to, again, speaking very much to the tech sector, is valued in this connectiveness vis-a-vis these other cities, is the way that we actually work with each other. I mean, we happen to have a very unique culture in terms of being able to embrace these entrepreneurs as well as others to help them get further along. And that is something that is a soft intangible sort of differentiator, but it is something that every one of these entrepreneurs would tell you is different than what they've seen down in the Bay Area or in New York or in Minneapolis or anywhere else.
So when you say education, you're talking about sort of the quality of K-12 education?
Yes, the quality of K-12 education would be sort of at a very high level, a simple way to say it.
Can I throw just a curveball on this and get your reaction? So, why am I echoing? Okay. You know, my wife teaches at PSU, so I get a lot of feedback from her about national searches for faculty. And what I consistently hear is that PSU cannot offer a competitive package. For the stars they're trying to recruit, PSU cannot offer a competitive package. You can make a lot more money teaching at other schools, including the public university system in New York and other places. What PSU therefore markets is the quality of life of living in this region. And so for a lot of people, they choose to come here sacrificing compensation for quality of life. So assuming that's what's happening in other areas, Joe, how are we ever going to remedy that? PSU is not tomorrow going to convince the legislature to invest in higher education at the levels we want, and yet it is a fundamentally important institution in our backyard. But they're getting people in spite of the compensation packages because of the larger benefits of living in this region. And I guess the flip side of that is, why is that a bad thing? Why should we look at that as a cup half empty if we're getting the talent?
This is the classic Ed White Law second paycheck argument, that there's a whole set of amenities that we get by living here in the Portland area that you can't buy at any price most other places. And I think economists are coming to the recognition that there's the dollar compensation you get and the quality of life compensation. It's those two things together. Now, obviously, if we can put more cash on the table, that helps too, I mean, in terms of competing with other places. But protecting and building on that quality of life as an asset to attract and retain people is, I think, has to be a fundamental part of our economic strategy. Now, the downside, as we know, and my colleagues at Eco Northwest have pointed this out, is we don't tax quality of life the same way we tax income. So that means if we have less cash income, there's less for you on the public finance side. But as an economic matter, that quality of life asset that we have is of huge economic importance.
And with all due respect to PSU, I don't think the problem is attracting the talent to PSU as much as those kids who are graduating PSU. Are we actually finding jobs for them here in Portland? I think there's a huge disconnect right now between the graduates coming out of PSU and the opportunities for them to stay in Portland to basically get employment. And that has to do with skill alignment as well as a lot of other things that have to do with being able to take our kids and fill our jobs. I would argue if I look in the tech sector, we're filling more of our tech sector jobs from kids that are moving here outside the state than we are from the folks that are here in the state, both at PSU as well as the state universities down south. So, you know, the teachers may be one thing, but I'm more interested in these kids being able to fill a growing number of jobs that are really great, high-paying jobs with skills that basically we can take them from one side of the city and put them into an office on the other side, and we're not doing that today.
As the father of a college senior, thank you for raising my blood pressure.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and again, I'll go back to, in all honesty, and maybe my bias, but the K-12 side of this, to me right now, is even more critical than us trying to figure out how to fix the I-5 corridor in PSU. I think that looking at the question that was asked across us against these other cities, you know, we do have so many issues as it relates to the state universities versus University of Washington or, you know, forget Stanford and Harvard and those guys. But we shouldn't have any disparity in K-12. We shouldn't have any reason why our K-12 schools, in terms of being able to get these kids on the right start and healthy households in K-12 and being able to attract really smart people who want to put their kids into public school, we should have no disparity between us and any city here, and we do.
Why do you think that is? Because as somebody who did come here and put kids in because of the great public school system and had kids going through the public school system, and for kids from families who are able to do well, they do well in Portland Public Schools and go on to...
I mean, which schools? You know, if you're on the west side and you're going to, you know, Lincoln, whatever. I mean, if you're on the east side, it's tough, right? I mean, and the kids who are coming in now, they actually want to live on the east side. You know, they really want to be in these neighborhoods that, partly because of housing cost, right? I mean, again, these are folks who are coming in with great jobs but no money. So partly housing costs. I mean, there's a whole connectedness towards what they can afford in the schools that they and wanting to be in public schools. So
I think if you look at the where the graduates of the East Side high schools are going to college, they're doing just as well as the West Side schools.
Yeah,
it's the kids
either.
Of less affluent families who are struggling and not graduating, and that's what gets Portland Public Schools a bad rap.
Yeah, and I can't speak to the stats in all honesty. What I do know is that we're invested in 7 large companies here in Portland. The talent, and we are hiring. All we do in every one of these companies is hire every single month, all levels of people. And the issue of the public schools has become one of the top 3 issues in every single hire in terms of win or lose these kids.
That's what I'm trying to understand, though, because I had experience both in East Side schools and West Side schools, and there's a lot of great stuff happening in our schools, and particularly for motivated families that are able to participate. So is it a perceived problem, or is it a an actual lack of quality education?
Well, perception is reality to some degree, but I believe that there are real issues. And being able to dig into that, in all honesty, I'm not the one to tell you where the real issues lie as much as to tell you the people who are basically saying that they're having the issues. So, apologize, I can't give you more data.
My daughter's a freshman at Cleveland.
So let me, you want to...
Oh, by the way, I wonder whether the issue is the quality of education through public schools or whether it's the related issue of the workforce development piece of matching graduates from high schools and colleges with the jobs we're trying to create. I hear that all the time, that there's a mismatch. Okay. I hear, you know, river-dependent businesses saying they can't find welders, and so we're not doing enough on the vocational education, and they want to hire people, give them a family wage job. I hear people in the creative economy saying we don't do a good enough job matching the graduates of our art schools and our colleges with those jobs that are emerging. I wonder if it's a little bit of both.
Both.
And thinking very strategically about how our talent competes for our jobs.
Both.
So why don't we dive into the plan, because we're really, this is the issues we're talking about.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm not, yeah. Jeez.
Thanks, Diane.
Well, I just thought Joe could speak to that, because it seems to me like it's a problem in aggregate, right? As a percentage of the population, not individual experiences, especially me being a highly motivated, highly educated parent in a Portland public school system. So I don't know that I'm necessarily the best case. I think we're talking about raising that baseline education across our population.
Yeah, my view would be, can you use this as an asset? Can you build it to differentiate your community from other places? And I think we're playing defense, basically. We're maintaining the system that we have, which does work well for some families and not well for other families. But we're living in a world where this is increasingly the big differentiator among places. And I think we could do a lot more to make it an asset rather than just defending the quality of what we have.
Yes, as the mother of 3 graduates of Portland Public Schools you couldn't buy the great education that they got. You just couldn't buy the kind of life skills that they learned. And when my second son went to Princeton, he said you could see the kids, you could tell which kids went to public schools and which kids didn't go to public schools by their ability to fit in. I worry that we've had a perception problem since Measure 5, that we've been cutting and struggling for state funding, which is necessary to ensure that all kids are successful. At the same time, we've been giving the impression that our public schools are not desirable, and they still are. All of the, you know, be principal for a day at Park Rose or David Douglas or Madison, and I
challenge the question, the assumption that the East Side schools are not doing well, because as Sarah said, for highly motivated families and with the capacity to engage, they're still great. So that's a challenge we have to get out, and Praxis part of our economic development strategy. How do we let folks know that there's still a lot of great things happening in the public education system? Yeah. It would be interesting to know what the percentage of families still sending their kids to public schools is. I know that it's less than in the high 90s when we looked at where do we want to live, but I bet it's still higher than some of these other cities.
Yeah. We can look at that, yeah.
It's 83 now, but what is it in the other cities? I know in Seattle
it's lower, yeah. Yeah, I agree.
Commissioner Ramey, I think that there is a big perception problem. Having sat through focus groups of high school students several years ago, I do think that there's sort of a lack of awareness of what skills match up to what jobs in the future. And I think that there's probably room to do some sort of teacher training and coaching so that, you know, the teachers themselves know, here's why this, you know, this class could be relevant to X job, and also probably expanding vocational education, et cetera. I mean, to the extent that there is a real issue in sort of the overall quality of education, though, I mean, from, you know, reading periodic articles, what distinguishes the United States from other countries that score better in international tests, if you take those seriously, usually it's those countries invest a lot more in teacher education, and also teachers have more time to plan and spend less time up front of the classroom. If those are real factors, then it would suggest that our economic development strategy, if this is a big part of our economic development, would be to build up one of the nation's best teaching, you know, colleges of education, and make a big investment in that, and also make a big investment in having more teachers so they have more time to plan and less time in the classroom. And I don't think that's going to be part of what we discussed today.
Right. And I know you want to move on, Patrick, but to that point, we know some of our target industries, and although healthcare isn't one of them, we know that that's a big part of our sector. We know that the Benson High School healthcare track is always oversubscribed, that we don't have enough capacity in that system to give the motivated kids who want to go into high-paying healthcare jobs that education in high school. So I think part of what we need to discuss as the City Council is continuing Future Connect, which we're getting a report on tomorrow, and also all hands raised in our partnership. It has to be interconnected, and I guess that's the takeaway I'm having from this discussion is PDC can't solve that problem.
Yeah, I do want to get into it because I think we're going to come back into this conversation, but one of the big questions that keeps getting asked in these conversations about our plan is yes, what is the scope of this plan? Because it immediately touches on all these other things. And we've had some great conversations, and you'll see we actually are putting forth, part of this is put forth a way in which we can rethink or update how we work, institutions work together to address some of these issues that go beyond any one entity, and education is probably the top of the list. So let me just see if I can move through the context for the plan and start to get into the goals, just so we can save enough time for more conversation. The way that we laid this out was we started by what are our strengths, what are we working with, and then we moved into our challenges. If you look at this next opportunities and assets slide, you know, really the premise is we have a strong growing economy. So we're in the midst of a very healthy recovery. We see a lot of job growth relative to the last time we did our strategy. Job growth isn't something that we're as concerned about, just because it's happening all around us. 5 years ago, that wasn't the case, and on top of that, we're seeing these industries that we've focused on doing particularly well, and you know, many of them are kind of recognized globally for their expertise, whether it be athletic and outdoor or clean tech industries. We've seen, as Diane mentioned, we've seen an unprecedented growth in our startup sector with significant investment in those firms. The mantra 5 years ago was if a company raised money from California, they were moving. That's pretty much never mentioned anymore. So we actually have an environment in which our firms can attract investment from anywhere in the world and still remain here. And then we're also staring at some significant opportunities for our city, namely the night cancer challenge, but also the expansion, you know, the more broadly the expansion of OHSU, the growth of PSU, the build out of these neighborhoods like South Waterfront and Central East Side, as significant, you know, almost, you know, kind of once in a generation opportunities for us to take advantage of. And a lot of the work that we've done over the past 5 years is also beginning to reap benefits in terms of a stronger foundation and workforce providers and community-based organizations to serve as partners for us. So, you know, when we talk to other cities and interact with them, where we've involved in a lot of kind of initiatives like that, whether it be with Brookings or the Pratt Center or the ULI stuff, most cities look at us like, wow, we'd love to have your problem. We'd love to have your situation. But needless to say, we do have challenges, and this plan is meant to focus on what the challenges are today, which are different than what they were 5 years ago. And so I think the fundamental challenge that we see, and you can look at it across a lot of different variables and metrics, is really kind of growing income inequality and wealth inequality. What's the recovery that's happening in this city is not an even recovery. It's benefiting certain parts of the city significantly more than others, and it's certainly benefiting certain demographic groups much better than others. And so we do see troubling indicators around poverty rates and income growth within our communities of color and within particular neighborhoods within the city of Portland. These metrics, I think, are all unacceptable to those of us who are in this work. So that is driving a lot of what we think we need to address in this plan. And then when you look at our peer cities, and this is why this look across the different cities is helpful, is because we do get a lot of national press and attention about what's going on in Portland, and there is a lot of positive growth in jobs and in population, but it's happening in a number of other places as well. And so it's, you know, it's useful to make sure that we do think about what is our college education attainment rate, not just relative to the national average, but relative to other peer cities and other things like investment in firms and startups. In our economic development business, just looking narrowly, there's, you know, people say, why are we comparing ourselves to San Jose or Seattle or Denver? Well, this is who we compete against. So there is this kind of simultaneous challenge that we're dealing with, which is how do we create an equitable city in which everyone prospers and remain globally competitive? And globally competitive means that we're competing against the best. We're not competing against below average. We're competing against the cities that do quite well. And so that's why we look at how we compare. And you know, it's not a clearly positive picture. And then the last piece of this, I think, is what a lot of us have been focused on in terms of kind of where poverty is increasingly concentrated in the city of Portland. We do have troubling demographic trends that are impacting our neighborhoods. Joe's team just released a study on the growing percentage of residents who are living in highly concentrated neighborhoods with highly concentrated poverty. However you look at it, we do have a growth in the number of households that are living in high poverty neighborhoods, and we all know that the outcomes from those neighborhoods are vastly different than in neighborhoods where poverty isn't concentrated. We believe that this is an issue that our plan needs to address. So that's so the
what's before you go. What is a VC? That was an
acronym. Venture capital. I'm sorry, venture capital investment. So it's just a typical measure of how our startups are able to access the capital needed to grow their businesses. Once again, while we're doing much better than we used to do, we still lag other cities in terms of access to venture capital.
Those of us of a certain age still assume VC means Viet Cong.
That's right. No Viet Cong. Okay, so after all this setup, now we are can talk about the draft framework that's in front of you. And this is kind of the highest level depiction of the plan. This is the kind of vision and goal for the plan. We started with just the goal when we first put this draft framework out, and our committee came back and said we need to aim higher. Achieving It says promote on your thing. That the goal actually is in the document achieving widely shared prosperity. But the committee said we need to have something that's bold and audacious. And so the vision is we added that in the next draft, the draft you're looking at. So the vision is for Portland to become one of the most globally competitive, desirable, and equitable cities in the world. So this is, as we were just talking about, it's a broader statement than what just PDC does, but this touches on so much of what PDC does that we think it's an appropriate vision for this plan. And as I just mentioned, we compete globally to grow our economy, but as Joe will point out, a lot of that's based on quality of life and where talent wants to be. And so this notion of being one of the most desirable cities is important. But as I just laid out in the challenges, that really the issue of equity is, I think, the most pressing challenge that we face. So we're trying to juggle these three complementary objectives as part of our vision. But the goal focuses in far more explicitly on the notion of equity. And so the goal is, once again, the PowerPoint, the word promote is there. It's really achieve is what we have in the document. But take the tools that we have, and implied in this plan is that the resources of other organizations to achieve widely shared prosperity among all residents of Portland. The measure.
So before you move on from that.
Yeah.
The challenge with that is one way to achieve that goal is to make it so expensive that everybody has to be prosperous to live here. So I think that there needs to be a second part of the goal about avoiding displacement of current residents or something to that end.
Okay.
Because otherwise we could get to the goal, but in ways that are not
right.
What we
know. You'll see as we get into the metrics, we're measuring it.
I still think there needs to be something in the goal to reflect. Yeah.
So the measure that we've put out is the measure of self-sufficiency, which is, you've seen the document in the footnote, it's a defined term. There's a standard that's established for self-sufficiency. And the Portland plan actually is pushing a goal of getting 80% of the households at or above self-sufficiency by the end of the Portland plan, which is 2035. What we're saying is we want to, by the time this plan is drafted, have our own goal for self-sufficiency. But Commissioner Fish and I have talked about this. But we'd love to put out there the long-term goal is that all households should be above self-sufficiency. We will never achieve it, but it's the aspiration we should have so that we don't say, check, we've hit it because we've hit a certain percentage. We're always working to move every household above self-sufficiency.
And you've got a footnote referencing the definition, but it just references a website. So could we get the actual definition of what self-sufficiency means in this context?
Yeah, so the self-sufficiency measure comes from the doctor who's mentioned in there, but it takes a look both at the cost, basically the income needed to support families without public subsidy at different sizes of families, so one adult, two adults, and two children, and so it ranges, for example, from about $19,000 for an individual adult, which is about $950 an hour, to for two adults and two kids, it would be about $65,000 a year, and so that translates into each adult making about $15.40. So, Work Systems is working with the University of Washington to assess right now the percentage of people in the city of Portland who meet the self-sufficiency criteria, and so there are a number of ways you can either, you know, effectively increase income, or you can look at things like transit access, housing affordability, to make sure that you have less cost. So it's a more complete analysis than the federal poverty level, for example.
Thanks. That would be helpful to have.
Yeah.
That
yes.
Right now.
I agree.
Okay.
Yeah.
And again, I value Portland because we're a community that cares about people and that takes care of people who can't take care of themselves entirely. So I think there should be some measure in the plan to recognize that public subsidies actually are going to be necessary and that we value people staying in Portland who need some help. I don't know how to quantify that because I know what you're trying to get to is that we're not having folks who are spending more than 30% of their income on housing, for example. But to get there, I think we should recognize that there is a role for government subsidies in helping people stay in Portland.
So in addition to the metric of self-sufficiency, we asked our committee, I guess challenged our committee, to think about what what widely shared prosperity means, more generally speaking, as a way to kind of define the rest of the plan. And so you, on the next slide, we've laid that out. But it is a combination of still going after fundamental economic growth, traded sector economic growth. So the pie has to grow. The traded sector piece of the economy remains critical. And so we have to still pursue economic growth, but then at the same time provide access across all aspects of the population to opportunity and also provide, as it says here, intergenerational economic mobility. So do we have the career ladders? Do we have wealth creation opportunities for all populations? And so it does touch on all these different things that we talked about, whether it be education, our neighborhood work, our redevelopment work becomes important because we can begin to seek the integration of jobs and place, but also we can seek economic integration across different income levels. So it's a pretty ambitious goal to be seeking widely shared prosperity. And so, as you'll see, we're trying to figure out how does that look in an implementation sense.
Patrick, what city can you point to that's been successful with a strategy like this? There's been a lot of reassessment lately about President Johnson's war on poverty, and I guess the consensus view now is that we made a hell of a dent with older adults, but we still have 50 million people in poverty. So it's a question I'm going to come back to later in the discussion about how do we define success and is this within our reach? But I guess I would start with, is there another city in America that has tasked its equivalent of PDC to solve something as profound as poverty?
I think a lot of cities are grappling with this exact same issue. I don't believe anybody is ahead of us in this. And we say that because we do talk with folks at Brookings and Pratt Center and other places, and we don't hear them come back with any other city that is farther along. And in fact, they give us credit for actually tasking ourselves with this. So there aren't many cities that are actually willing to task themselves with this or integrate it in the way that we're proposing to integrate it. So, you know, yes, we want job growth. We want job growth that benefits everybody. I think a lot of cities are still saying, we want job growth, and then we'll worry about, you know, how we make everybody equal through some other policy objectives.
I'd say also to add, just within my discussions within the U.S. Conference of Mayors, I would say there are a lot of cities that are thinking about income inequality. And there are some of those cities that have adopted individual tactics that we may want to emulate, whether it's a returning citizens incentive that they have in Philadelphia that's hiring ex-offenders, or local wage policies, you know, where other cities are farther down that policy road than we are. But in terms of an integrated strategy, no, but some individual sort of points of light in terms of leadership initiatives.
And then, and I would just say, this is a fairly provocative thing, but there's a lot of literature out there that the cities that are more successful than others on the middle income, middle wage job front, which is a big part of this, are the cities that we don't typically emulate. They're cities that aren't as attractive to the creative class and the millennials. So cities like the Houstons of the world are actually economically able to maintain a more diverse kind of employment picture. And so I think I think we're trying to do is kind of have the best of both. And I'm not sure who else is out there trying to do that.
So let me offer an analogy.
There you go. You're on.
Oh, sorry. So let me offer just an analogy and maybe a cautionary tale. When I got elected and was asked to lead the Housing Bureau, one of the first things I did is I brought in the smartest person that I could find and paid him a big fat fee as a consultant to go over the books and records of my bureau and tell me what we do well, and what we should be focused on. And Steve Novick spent a couple of months going through all the books and records. And I remember the first time we sat down with him and our team, and he presented some of his preliminary findings. And one of them was, he said, with your resources, and the breadth of the bets you're making on all kinds of things, you're at great peril of not moving the needle on anything. It politically serves and addresses a lot of the demands of the community. You're making little bets here and here and here and here. But the cautionary flag